This is an interview with Gladman Humbles.
Humbles.
Humbles. The interviewer is Betsy Brinson and takes place at Mr. Humbles' residence in Paducah, Kentucky. Could you just give me your complete name, please?
It's Gladman C. Humbles.
Okay, and Gladman is G-L-A-D-M-A-N?
Correct.
And your last name?
H-U-M-B-L-E-S.
The L-E-S, okay. Well, thank you very much for agreeing to talk with me this morning. Any number of people have suggested your name to me as someone who would be an authority both on the history of Paducah and this topic, which is to eliminate, the whole effort to eliminate legal segregation in Kentucky from 1930 to 1974. Now, I know we may go before that, we may talk a little bit more present, but thank you for talking with me. Could we begin, should I call you Mr. Humbles?
Mr. Humbles, Gladman, either one. Either one's fine. Gladman's fine, that's
okay,
good.
Could we begin a little bit about you, where and when you were born?
I was born, legally I was born here in Paducah, but I was really born in Kansas City. In fact, I'm writing a book about my biological mother and the search I had for her and all the interesting things that happened. The book's called Finding Mama, and I'm quite well into the book now. The book's nearing completion. But for all legal reasons, I was born in Paducah.
Okay. And Did you came here at a very early age?
I was less than a year old. I was a few months old.
Okay. And what's your birthday?
December the 3rd, 1930.
And so that makes you
69
years old. Okay. Could you tell me a little bit about your growing up, specifically here in Paducah, your family, any brothers and sisters or grandparents that or ancestors that you have heard about in growing up?
My father was well up in age when I was conceived, and my father was my actual father, but my mother wasn't my actual mother. She accepted me as her own, however. In growing up in Paducah as a young boy, the patterns of segregation were not as rigid as in the Deep South, but however they existed. For example, in my book I mentioned where we had a swimming hole down at the river, and we went there to swim, and we kind of thought that was our own private swimming hole. And whites had a nice swimming pool out at the Noble Park, the municipal park. There was a kind of a mixed pattern of segregation. For example, we could sit anywhere on the bus with the bus system. We didn't have to move back and give our seats to whites as they did in places like Birmingham, where the civil rights movement really got kicked off. We couldn't ride in white taxicabs, however. But at that time, there were four black taxicabs in Paducah. Down at Kresge's, I remember we could stand up at a counter and almost...
Kresge's.
Oh, that was it.
K-R-E-S-A-G-E, is that
K-R-E-S-G-E...
Apostrophe S.
Apostrophe S. It was a 5 and 10 store, which they don't have anymore now. It's a dollar and up store.
Right.
But anyway,
Let me just stop you 1 minute here, please.
Okay.
I just wanted to move the fan so the noise would...
Okay, I forgot. It's the air purifier. That's good.
So go ahead. You were telling me about...
Is it back on?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, at the 5 and Dime store, there was a lot of black people worked downtown, and you could stand up, but you couldn't sit down at the lunch counter. Mm-hmm. And... Of course, the movie theater was segregated. We had a balcony, and we paid quite a bit less money. The schools were segregated. There was kind of a caste system in a way, because some people of affluence, some African Americans of influence and of affluence, I should say, they could go downtown and be treated quite courteously. And in fact, they might allow them to try on some clothes. But as a general rule, you just had to buy, had to guess your size and buy. Of course, the churches were completely segregated.
Did your family belong to a church in Paducah?
They went to Washington Street Church, Baptist Church. All of the eating establishments were segregated, restaurants and dairyettes and so forth. Of course, dairyettes you could go to the window and carry out. And there were a lot of places where you could carry out stuff you couldn't sit down. I remember a place down on 2nd Street where people were, including myself, I worked downtown at the time, I was a young boy, and going to school, and you could go back in the kitchen and eat, but you couldn't sit out front. And
do you remember the name of that place?
It was Lambert's Restaurant.
Lambert's Restaurant.
Yes. Okay. They had plate lunches back then for 35 cents.
Was the food good?
Quite good. They had black cooks in the kitchen. And if I should be completely honest, which I'd like to be, except for the economic part of it and the fact that we had a substandard school, just the fact that we weren't totally unhappy with segregation, as a social side of it, What we were unhappy with was the fact that, for example, I shined shoes as a young boy, and sometimes while going to school, I made $35 a week. And
how old were you? What
I was
age range was that?
About 14. Okay. And that was a godly amount of money.
Right.
So
by then, it was in the
1940s. 1940s. Right.
Probably during and after the war.
Right.
War II.
Right. Okay. I remember the little humorous incident that happened. I worked in a real classy barbershop downtown. Worked after school on Saturdays. And my father didn't want me to work there because he was afraid of the. He was quite protective of the family. And he felt like that I would be called the N word. And he's. Didn't know how I would handle it. Just told me to keep my mouth shut, get my things up, and come on. Well, there were two incidents that happened. One being that this well-dressed woman had her son there and was going to a Life magazine and having him to pick out certain things in the magazine, like this is a house, this is a car. At that time, Joe Louis had won a fight, and when he got to that page, he said, "Mama, I know what this is. This is a nigger." But that didn't, the woman and I kind of communicated with our eyes and facial expressions because she admonished the child. And I looked at her in such a way to say, well, you know, you probably taught him this. So therefore, why are you jumping on him? You know, he would be bewildered. We communicated without saying anything in this particular. But another incident happened which caused me to quit the job. There was an old man who used the N-word so frequently. I didn't really know him at the time he came in, but I found out something about him later. I won't call his name. He still has people here. He came in, and I'm not giving you this information to cause any friction. But anyway, he came in, and I was sitting by the shine stand, and he poked me with his cane and said, "I see you got your new nigger here." And I think this is what my father was talking about. And I just didn't know, I just froze up and didn't know what to do. And he wanted to know, could I talk? And he wanted to know, could I grin? And he wanted to know what was wrong with me. And I just became, I was so sensitized to the situation until I just almost cried, but I didn't want to cry. And then he wanted to rub his hand. He said I had curly hair. He wanted to rub his hand through my head. And I said, no, I said, I'd rather you not do that. I said, it's just something bad might happen. I just felt like I had gone as far as I could go and I had to make a stand. And it seemed as though he caught the message and he turned around and left. And I got my little brushes and rags together and I left out the shop. The shop was in the big 10-story bank building. The short name for it was a 10-story building. So the barber followed me out and he says, are you going to quit? I said, yes, I'm going to quit. And he tried to give the impression that this, not to be so sensitive, this was a harmless old man and so forth. Well, I became kind of incensed at the barber because I thought he was more intelligent than the old man. The way I look at it, an ignorant man with money is just an ignorant man with money. But an intelligent person with or without money is an intelligent person. And this was an ignorant old man with money and felt like he could just do as he pleased. And as I got older, I never forget that incident.
How old do you think you were?
I was around 14. And of course, I came home and told my father about it. And that's not quite the end of the story. So I started going to the marketplace with my father. The current Market House, which is a museum, they call it the Market House Museum. Back in the 40s, it was a real marketplace. You could go there and buy all kind of vegetables, meats, everything. So my father was a man, I guess you would say, of wealth back then, by black standards anyway. Mm-hmm. And
how did he make his living?
Well, my father made his living through real estate. He rented houses and bought and sold property. And he owned a garage, owned interest in a garage downtown. My father was very fair, but he would go down there as night watchman to kind of watch his investment. But anyway, when this man approached my father while he was buying some meat, I pulled my father's coat and said, Daddy, that's the man that called me these names. And my father gave him a good tongue lashing, and he said, I didn't know that was your son. He said, well, you shouldn't talk to any boy like that, you know. And my father grabbed me by the arm and took me home, and there was a lot of tension in the house because this man was the most prominent, if not the most prominent, one of the most prominent white men in town, wealth-wise and so forth. And my father got his gun and sat by the door, and I was all excited. My mother was crying. And when things calmed down, I asked Daddy, and I said, you told me to behave myself when I went to the barbershop and not say anything. And you curse that old man out, and he has all this money, and he's white. Why did you do that? He said, well, you don't have any power, any sense, or any money, anything. You're just a boy. He said, I don't have very much, but I wasn't going to let him get away with what he did to my son. And I had the opportunity then and there to do it. And I took a calculated gamble because I felt like he would not have wanted the embarrassment of a black man talking to him the way I did to tell anybody about it. He said, but my home is the only thing I have that I cherish, and therefore I came home and I got my gun because I wasn't going to let anybody in here without a warrant. So my dad was he stood up pretty well.
Tell me your father's name.
William Mumbles. Okay. He came from Virginia on a honeymoon, and he sold property. He could buy houses in for $300 and $400, and he was going to Kansas City on a honeymoon. Stopped here to see a relative who was a Dr. Isabel on my mother's side, and he never made it to Kansas City. He just stayed here.
Mm. Liked it okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Did you have any brothers and sisters growing up?
Well, not growing up. They had a son back, I don't know, my father came here in the early, around 1900 or even before then, and they had a son named Alton, and Alton is a victim of discrimination also. Alton had the case of diphtheria, and he was, there was only one doctor that I know of back when I was a child that would see black people. And I remember a cut fell out on my toe, which I was tampering with, and cut my big toe off. It's still a big, you can still see the stitches, and he sewed it up. But anyway.
Was he white?
Yes, he's Dr. Froge. And at the time, Froge, F-R-O-A-G-E. Okay. And at the time, of course, eventually we had, I believe, three or four doctors, but black doctors. Mm-hmm. I believe it was four. But Dr. Froge was the only doctor that would look after, and of course the hospitals, there was only one hospital you could go to. At that time it was called a Riverside Hospital. I don't know exactly who ran it. But anyway, Alton had diphtheria, and they were giving him medicine. Now, I don't know whether they carried him to Dr. Froge or not, but they carried him out of town to some doctors, and they were giving him some medicine, which was the wrong medicine, and they carried him to St. Louis, and they said he had diphtheria, but it was too late to do anything about it, and this medicine was working adversely against him. So he died at 5, and I think that's why my mother, the mother that I knew, accepted me so well.
So you grew up really as an only child?
Yes, I did. Okay.
Tell me about your education.
My education was at Lincoln School.
An all-black school.
It was an all-black school. I guess I was, my mother was a motivational factor in me finishing because I ran away to the circus one time.
How old were you when you did that?
I was in the 11th grade, so I should have been around 16, I guess, 15, 16. I didn't stay very long because I didn't like the harsh conditions of the circus life.
What prompted you to run away, though, to them?
Well, there was a circus on the edge of town here. One, it stayed here all the summer. They were getting up. Mm-hmm. And I was in a class play, and my father wouldn't buy me a suit. And I had one suit. And he thought that was enough, and we got into an argument about it, and I just wanted to change for acts, you know, kind of show off a little bit. And I made a threat. Sometimes you have to be careful of the threats you make, because you can't, you might. So I made a threat to go off of the circus. They had a big sign out there to join the circus and see the world, but I never saw the world. I just saw one show lot to the other show lot. Mm-hmm. I didn't even know what went on, and I didn't even know what town we were in sometimes. But anyway, I thought I could bluff him into buying a suit, and my dad was a very strong man when it came to having his way, pretty much. Mm-hmm. And my mother, I worked the game on her to upset her, but anyway, the bottom line was I packed my little bag, and when I left, he didn't beg me back or anything. He didn't. I just wanted to left to show him that I would do it. But when I got some money together and I called my mother and she was crying and begged me back, I said, well, I better go ahead and stop this game before it's too late, before I overplay my hand. So then I came on back home.
So you didn't miss any school time?
Well, I had to take makeup tests.
Okay, you did miss. Okay.
I missed some time. I was gone about a month, and I had to take makeup. My mother had, she had gone to the school, and the teachers would allow me to pass tests and do back homework and all. So that was in the 11th grade, so I attribute that to her that I did finish high school, okay. Which I'm happy about.
And were there 11 grades or 12 grades?
12 grades.
Okay. Tell me about the Lincoln School. For example, how many were there in your graduating class, approximately?
Classes were small by the time. Well, classes were always small, to my knowledge, at Lincoln. We had maybe, at the very most, 25 people.
Okay. And what year did you
graduate? 1948.
1948, okay. And were you aware of any differences while you were in school between the black school and the white school?
Very much aware. We I don't want to say anything to denigrate the principal, or I don't want to say anything derogatory about it, but the principal seemed to fit a mold that we're doing okay over here, we don't need anything else. Mm-hmm. We played in the football team, for example, we played in hand-me-down togs from the white school. The curtain, I remember, for the stage was a canvas curtain instead of a velvet curtain. In this article I wrote, they didn't even have an office practice class until the NACP, Curly Brown was the president then, they finally got one through his insistence. But the principal, I think, was a good man and wanted us to do well, but he wasn't the kind of man that would be aggressive or push anything. He would just let the status quo remain. And we couldn't play on the, we had to play at a place called Hooks Park and clean the manure off. At this time, Hooks had gone down, and we had to clean the manure off and run the shoe the cows off and to even have a, and put the lime down to even have a game. But there was a highly noticeable and remark. We used to always say, why can't we have this, why can't we have that? But we weren't happy, we weren't unhappy as being with the camaraderie of a bunch of black kids trying to survive in a world we didn't create. And so some of us did quite well. And incidentally, I wrote two articles about Lincoln School, which have become, they've become keepsakes in all over the country. I had one article is over there on the wall, and I did a sequel to that. And
maybe at some point you could share a copy of those with me to
I'll give you copies.
Okay.
Yeah.
Can you tell me anything about the teachers at Lincoln School? Do you know, and you may not remember this, but do you have any recollection of where they received their own training as teachers?
Well, I don't have a recollection of where they received their training. At the time that I was in school, the local college, state college facility was Kentucky State. But however, many teachers came here from some other place, and I could not tell you exactly where they received their training. But I can tell you something about the teachers. As any other educational institution, we had good teachers and bad teachers. I'm not going to put them all on the pedestal and say they were all good, because I think we had caring and uncaring teachers. I think we had some that looked at it like, this is a good job for me. I remember teachers would use the phrase, I've got mine, you got yours to get, which I didn't think was a nice thing to say. It was like, if you want to learn, you can. If you don't, I'm still going to get paid. But on the whole, I believe that the learning process, I believe it consists of a desire to learn, that even under a bad teacher, if you want to, you can get out into books and learn yourself. Of course, a teacher can motivate you and help you a lot, but you have to do the learning.
During this period, well, really up until the 60s in Kentucky, teachers who wanted to do graduate work would have to go out of the state, and they received scholarship money from Kentucky to do that. Did you ever hear about any of the teachers at Lincoln going off in the summer to Indiana or Ohio or New York or other?
Yes, I can't recall the exact ones that did it, but some teachers went on to get their master's. Mm-hmm. And of course, that back then, now you have to have a doctorate to be kind of recognized pretty well, but back then a master's was a great achievement. And I know myself, even I decided to study pharmacy after I left the service and drifted around for a while, and I couldn't go to Kentucky State. I went to Creighton in Omaha. I didn't complete it, but I went there a couple of years. But back then, some of them did go off other places and came back.
What about the textbooks that you had at Lincoln School?
Well, the textbooks, I don't know what type of textbooks Tillman had, which was a white school, but we had adequate textbooks, I would say. We had, of course, some of them were worn quite badly, but as far as the content of the textbooks, I think the material was there. We even studied black history at Lincoln.
Well, so. I wanted to ask you about that, in fact. Do you talk about that a little bit?
Okay. Well, there were two teachers, one named Ms. Weston and one named Ms. Sullivan, and they taught black history out of a, I can't think of the name of the book. In fact, I was trying to get a copy. Ms. Sullivan passed just not too long ago, but her kids wouldn't part with that book for anything. But anyway, it wasn't a very thick book, but we did have a black history course, and we knew about we knew about people that are icons in black history as children. You know, we knew about Sojourner Truth and Nat Turner and all these people because we had that course. Mm-hmm. And as I told you before, when we started this, Kentucky is kind of, it's been a strange situation here in Kentucky. Even though Kentucky was a border state that held on to slavery to the bitter end, Kentucky didn't want to give it up. But the 13th Amendment and 14th Amendment, of course, Emancipation Proclamation didn't free blacks here in Kentucky because they were not in rebellion against the Union. But at the same time, the 13th Amendment, it did. And I just did an article on this too. I have about slavery in Kentucky and so forth, and in Paducah.
Let me stop you and ask a couple questions. When you had black history at Lincoln School, at what age, what grade was that?
We had it in two levels. We had it, I think, Mrs. Weston. I know I had two teachers in black history, but I would say we had it around the ninth grade, and again, probably in the 11th grade. I'm not sure of that.
And every student had it?
Yes.
Okay, it wasn't an elective or anything?
Yes, okay. It was a course.
You mentioned the Emancipation Proclamation, and I was interested to read that Paducah has been celebrating the Emancipation Proclamation for, I guess, it's a long time anyway. And I read in the newspaper recently that you do it on August 8th.
That's correct.
Why do you do that instead of January?
Well, that's kind of ironical that you asked that. I just finished an article, which I did a lot of research on, and there are several theories about that. But none of them hold water, actually. We just don't know. No one has ever been able to actually find out. A professor at the college named Roberts, he wanted to say one time that I think that the Haitians, we celebrated in conjunction with them, but they didn't celebrate on August the 8th in Haiti. Mm-hmm. And another thing that was...
That must be John Roberts.
John Robertson.
And he wrote a history of
right.
Paducah. That's right. And you're right, I believe he... I remember him saying that the event here at one period brought people from all over Louisville and others on
correct.
The train and whatnot, and that it became a big sort of recreational event as well as
correct.
A historical event, that you had a baseball team, I believe. Or
oh, we had everything. We had everything. Okay. I mean, in a line of sports, we had, I mean, kids pitched horseshoes, baseball, softball, basket, everything. Uh-huh. It was all done in one day, and it was something going on all over town. Mm-hmm. And, of course, we had one of the best baseball players in the country, if not the best, catchers, mm-hmm. named Patterson. His nickname was Kid, and James Patterson, Robert Patterson. But anyway, I just did an article on this, and some say that it was the weather was cold in January. Then there's another.
theories around the
right.
proclamation date.
Yeah, some said, you know, the weather was cold in January, but that doesn't hold so because Kentucky slaves were not freed under the Emancipation Proclamation. Now, there's another theory that goes around to say that the Emancipation Proclamation in itself caused such a chaos and confusion that Kentucky slaves heard about it in their slave cabins, and when they went to the fields to work, they just wouldn't work, which very well may have been the first labor strike. And that the abolitionists were so much against slavery, and there was resentment growing against it until the slave owners didn't know what to do. They weren't going to shoot them all, and they didn't want to cause a rebellion, so they were just at a loss to know what to do, and it created so much chaos. So eventually, with slaves not working at all, they were turned loose. And of course, they were turned loose. They were barefooted and didn't have any money. So no one knows the date that they were turned loose, actually, here in Kentucky. But they enlisted in the army, and they headed for the big cities like Lexington and Louisville. And you have to realize, in walking, it might have taken, they would leave maybe in early August and probably walk to Lexington or Louisville, which was a pretty good hike from Paducah. Then there's another strange story I read, the anti-slavery movement in Kentucky. It's you can't check it out. It's for the reading room. It said that this slave owner was named Hayes. A slave told this story and said he called his slaves together, and he said, I'll kind of shorten it. He says, as of this day, all of you are freed, but if I had my way, I'd kill Lincoln if he were here for taking you away from me. Now go to the granary and let's all get whatever you want. Let's have a party. And the slave owner said, we had one big jubilee. I mean, the slave did. And said, Hayes joined them. So the book didn't say that happened in Paducah, but, and it didn't give a date. So it's all speculative as to why this exists. I know some fellow brought me a paper. I don't have it. And they were celebrating the 8th of August back here in the 1800s and had events in the paper about it, different parks and places. Did you know that?
No, I didn't.
Yeah. Well, a man that's interested in that kind of stuff, he brought me a paper about it.
So back in the late 1800s?
Yes. After it was being celebrated here in Paducah.
When do you think you first got interested in history?
Well, history is such a fascinating... I knew that when I decided to study pharmacy, I didn't think it would be too exciting, just pushing pills off from one tray to bottle. But I got interested in history as I went to, first of all, I was the first African-American on the Paducah Fire Department, and it gave me a lot of time to read. And I'm not a historian by any means, but it gave me a lot of time to read while we didn't have training and drill and out on fire. And so I found history to be a rather fascinating subject, and in particular African-American history and American history. And I got interested in it just through quest for knowledge and curiosity and wanting to know where this came from, how this happened, what caused this, and so forth.
Okay. I want to go back a minute because you've mentioned a couple things, and I want to try and put them in a time perspective here. When you graduated from high school, you mentioned, I believe, going into the military?
I went to California first and lived a while.
Okay. And why did you go to California?
Well, I had some relatives there, and I felt like Paducah didn't offer me anything at the time. Mm-hmm. My options were so limited. At one time, I didn't mention this when we were talking, but at one time, the railroad shops was the best job you could get in Paducah, and blacks were relegated to the nastiest, dirtiest job, sandblasting, health health-threatening jobs, sandblasting, cleaning old engines and getting the scale and stuff off of them. And so teachers made $2,500 a year when I graduated, or maybe $3,000 at the most, which wasn't, it sure wasn't, it wasn't, I think at somewhere along the line, black teachers started making as much as white, earning as much. But anyway, none of those things appealed to me, and I just said, well, I'll just go to Los Angeles. And
tell me your graduation year again.
1948.
Okay. So, go to Los Angeles.
Went to Los Angeles, and a love affair went sour. I started falling in love there. It went sour, and I went on and enlisted in the Air Force and stayed there for close to 6 years. Came back here and drifted a while, and then I went off to college, and my father had a prostate operation, but then my mother's heart failed on her, and she died, and I came back here and looked after my father for a while, and I just sort of got stuck.
And when you went to college, was that to Creighton?
Right.
In Iowa?
In Omaha.
Omaha, mm-hmm. Nebraska, that's
right.
And you enrolled in the pharmacy program.
Right.
You said, but I take it you didn't love it.
No, well, I just looked at it as something nice to do and mm-hmm. not too hard. And
did you ever work in a pharmacy?
No.
No.
Mm-mm. So it was a 6 or 7 year. It was pre-pharmacy then pharmacy, yeah. So you had to go through your regular curriculum and then go, mm-hmm. you know, then get into the pharmacy business.
Do you remember how you heard about Creighton? What took you there?
Yeah, well, it's interesting. I had a good friend here, and he wanted to get away from Paducah too, and we decided that we would definitely go west for some reason. And we took darts and put a map up, and one hit close to Creighton. I'd been accepted at Creighton at the University of Minnesota, and the dart hit closer to Creighton, and that's where we decided to go to Omaha.
Okay. So you came back here with your parents' illness, and then what?
Well,
and where are we now into what, the late 50s?
We're into the, yes, okay. And we're into, well, there's something that, it's interesting here. I was married at this time and had a child son, and we had used a laundromat in Creighton. And the first thing...
You used the
laundromats.
The laundromat, uh-huh, okay.
And I guess you might say that I was indirectly responsible for the first integration that came about in Paducah. We came back, and of course we had been using the laundromats there in Omaha. And we had this young child, and we were turned down at all the laundromats. Now this was in, I'd say around, my mother died in 57. It was around in 57. So I told my wife, she was from Kansas. She was kind of amazed at this, but I told her, I said, well, let's don't get angry. Let's just get smart and build a laundromat. So I got up enough money and went into the laundromat business. And I noticed these white laundry owners would come by my place, and they would look and look and look, and I would just had the place packed. And soon thereafter, all the white laundromats, that was the first public accommodation that integrated here in Paducah. And they started giving discounts and all. I'm not going to blame it all on them, but I learned that you can't compete unless you really got something good going, because there's just too much out there for you. So, but indirectly, I was the cause of the laundromats being integrated.
And where was your laundromat?
It was down on 7th Street, which probably was a mistake too, because if you go in business, you got to look at it from a people perspective and not black or white. It's open for people to come here and do business.
And you integrated your laundromat too?
Well, it was integrated, but you know, it was 7th Street is not, wasn't the best of locations, but it was where all the black businesses were. And it was integrated, but I didn't get very much white business. But they wanted this black business because they saw these people coming in droves. When I first opened, I was, you know, I had to have help and everything, but it just weaned on down.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So how long do you think you had that business?
Oh, about five, 6 years.
And did it actually take that long before the white owners opened up theirs? Or?
No, they opened up theirs. I did well for about a couple of years, and it started just going downhill. Right. And I was trying to keep it up on pride more than common sense.
Right. You mentioned the 7th Street area as being a black business district, and I understand that there was also a hotel here that...
Yeah.
I don't know the name of it, though.
Metropolitan.
That they're trying to restore.
Right.
Is that down in the 7th
Street? It's off of 7th Street. It's on Jackson's, let me see, on Jackson Street.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Between 7th, it's closer to 8th than to 7th.
Right. Okay. Mm-hmm. So when you came back here from California, Gladman, the Brown decision in 54 and the implementation decision in 55 would have come down. What was happening at the point of your return with integrating the school system in Paducah?
Well, the school systems integrated without the we never had to have any, to my knowledge, we never had to have any, I think perhaps we had a little pockets of dispute, or we didn't have any what you call horrendous violence. We had probably some name calling and some resentment and some, but for the most part, if you compare it with the Deep South, the schools integrated here without too much fanfare. There were a couple of things that happened. We had some I know Bill Black Jr., who's doing the school system as a dissertation. I did have the book. I don't know what I gave it back. I think I gave it back to him. There were a few biased teachers where black students excelled and they gave them lower grades. And they let them know, I'm in charge and I give you what I want, or, you know, that's the grade you got. We had some of that. But as far as the type of incidents that happened in Mississippi and Alabama.
Even up in Sturgis.
Yeah, right. Sturgis, that's a good example. I forgot about Sturgis.
Because I think it was the National Guard from Paducah, wasn't it, that they called into Sturgis.
You're correct. You're right. But we didn't have that type of thing. The schools, I won't say it was done with complete finesse and smoothness, but I will say that it was done in an orderly manner.
This is not entirely fair of you, since you weren't here to ask you this, but how did they do it? Did they just say, if you're a black student and you want to go to a white school, you can do it? Or was there some sort of systematic arrangement?
I think that's the way it was. I think, because you're jogging my memory on it now, they kept Lincoln School and let those that wanted to go to Tillman go. And probably they thought, of course, it's quite expensive to keep a dual school system. But they started off by letting those who wanted to go to Tillman go. Because I don't know exactly what year, because Lincoln stood for 5 or 6 years after integration, because there were enough students to justify its being there. And there was still kind of a mentality that the more blacks we could keep at Lincoln, the less we'll have out here. Mm-hmm. There was still that kind of, but then Lincoln got unfeasible after so long. People said, well, you know, they got better this over there, better that, and it's a better building, it's a better science class, it's more, you know, we only had one Bunsen burner, for example, in a science class. And so people gradually just started saying, I think I'm going to send my kid over to Tillman, and Lincoln just closed the doors.
Was there ever any busing?
There was busing, yes. It's kind of ironical the way the busing system changed. When we were kids, we walked to school, and they were busing white kids in to Tillman from out in the county area. They didn't have all the schools they have now. And then they started busing black kids to Tillman. But there was not a big, for the most part, I don't want to give Paducah any more than it's due, but for the most part, we have not had complete racial harmony here by any means, but we've not had an ugly, nasty type thing.
I've read that in the early 50s, the population was growing in Paducah, and there was actually a bond resolution put forth. I don't know what happened to it, but it was to build several new black schools and several new white schools. Can you recall, were there any new schools that were built?
No, I'm afraid I'm lost on that one.
Well, it may not have passed.
I don't...
They would have had to do something if there were...
What year was that?
50-51.
Well, I was in the service then.
Right, mm-hmm. Okay. But there aren't that many new schools that you're aware of.
No, I don't... I know.
Okay. Who, how do you spell Tillman, first off, and who is
T-I-L-G-H-M-A-N.
And who was Tillman? A school was named after.
It was named after, I believe it was named after Confederate General. I'm not sure.
Oh, Benjamin Tillman?
Yeah, I can't. Lloyd Tillman.
Lloyd Tillman, mm. Okay. Okay. Mm. Abraham Lincoln and Lloyd Tillman, huh? Okay. Okay. So when you had the laundromat here, and how was it for you coming back after you'd been in the military, which had moved more into integration? You lived in California, which was another kind of culture. You mentioned your wife being a little surprised about laundromats here, but how was it for you generally to come back here?
Well, it's something I didn't really relish but I knew that I would have to take care of my father because with the loss of his wife, his mind deteriorated. He had any number of problems, and he was on up in his years. But it was something I didn't really relish, but it was something I knew I had to do. And I had seen a little bit of the world, and I had I was able to go where I wanted to, more or less, and do what I wanted to. And when I came back, it was kind of it just wasn't good for me. To tell you the truth about it, I didn't feel. I made the best of it, but I didn't really. When I was a younger person, it didn't seem to bother me so much. But I said, you know, here I can't even go to see a good play, or a good show, or anything like this. A good jazz band, or club, and it was just all. It's like coming back to the country, you know.
Right.
Watching the cows.
So it wasn't ideal, but what was going on in your life at that point in time? Did you decide that you were going to make it better in some way? Or?
Well, I did. I worked with the NAACP closely, and I'd like to get to something if I could. It's, you know, I was the first black on the Paducah Fire Department, which, in my opinion, it wasn't an honor. It was kind of a horror story. But it was when my laundry started going down, I was selling all these concessions, pop and candy and cigarettes, and it was just barely keeping it afloat. And it was a bottler down the street. His wife lives there now, named George Jacobson. He came down and talked to me, and I liked George. He'd been mayor of Paducah, and he'd been a city commissioner. And he wanted to know how I was selling. He said, "You're selling much pop as a small grocery store." And I said, "Well, I'm selling at a discount, and if I get my bottles back, it's kind of helping pay the bills. He says, I said, George, you know, I'm going to have to get a job. And he said, well, why don't you, you want a job? I said, yeah. He said, well, why don't you get on that fire department? I said, well, they're not hiring blacks on the fire department. I said, he said, that's going to change. He said, they will hire. He said, he said, I'll help you get on.
And this would have been about what period?
This was 1963.
Okay.
It's the Bill of Lowry in 59. Mm-hmm. And so a strange thing happened about getting on this fire department. Two commissioners had seen the handwriting on the wall. One was named A.B. Finley, and one was named Albert Carnes. He was a lawyer.
And Carnes.
Carnes, K-A-R-N-E-S.
Okay.
Finley was a funeral director. And they were both city commissioners. And they had told the fire chief, this was before any mandate was made, but they had seen this happening in other places, and they wanted to kind of get things going in Paducah without being pushed into it. So they told the fire chief to go out and find some blacks for the fire department. Fire chief didn't want to do that, but he went out and he looked and said he couldn't find any. So when George was a kind of conservative type fella, and Joe Freeland, who was a lawyer for the NAACP, he was a liberal. And I saw an advantage of playing both ends against the middle. So I talked to, after George said he would help me, I went to Freeland for help, but I didn't let Freeland know that George said he would help me. And I had Freeland working on one end and George working on the other end. So that's the way I got on the fire department.
So did you have to go down and apply?
Oh, yes, I had to do that.
And what was that process like? What did they say to you? What did they tell you that you needed to do? Or?
Well, you know, it was kind of, I kept my cool. I didn't, but I thought, you know, they told me I was going to be called nigger and called names. And they asked me, they said, you're being a, you're like Jackie Robinson. And I came close to saying, if I'm like Jackie Robinson, so why don't you pay me like baseball paid Jackie Robinson? Mm-hmm. But back then, the pay was like $270 a month mm-hmm. when I went on. It's been 30-some years. I went on in 63, so that's been a long time. But it was below what plants were paying. But I looked at it as, I didn't really think I would stay, but I'm a kind of a stubborn type fellow. If you push me the wrong direction, I'll push back. So
you stayed how long?
29 years.
29 years,
yeah.
Okay.
I'm retired.
In the beginning, though, were there requirements that you had to stay at the firehouse overnight?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Whatnot. Did that pose a problem for?
Yes, it did. It was, it would take another 2-hour session or longer. Just say that I was like the fly in the milk. If you want to, you know, I was just a. Well, if I look back on it, it's something I can understand in a way. They had never been conditioned. The fire department was an all-white outfit. It had been kind of a political plum for whites, and here I come onto the scene. It's something different, something new, something.
You're talking about the fire department.
Yes, well, there was, I don't want to enumerate things that happened, but there are a lot of things that happened that it was like, I'm just, here I am coming on the scene, and I'm just messing up a good deal for them. That's, in fact, there was only 2 or 3 people that even spoke for a long time. But I'm a person who tries to turn adversity into advantage. And
well, I don't want to have you talk about things you don't want to, but I'd be interested in knowing, for example, how did you handle eating together? How did you handle sleeping together in the beginning?
Well, I slept with one eye open. But anyway, It was kind of ironical. When I first went there, they were having union meetings, and they told the chief they didn't want me eating with them. Well, I felt like I've never wanted to eat with anyone that didn't want me to eat with them. That's kind of a private matter. It's just, if I go to a restaurant, I'm not going to some white person's table and sit down at their table. You know, that's they're with their group and I with mine. But anyway, it was something funny that happened. You can say it's funny, but it's... my wife would bring me my meals, and she cooked nice meals and brought them to me. And so one day I was getting transferred to another station, and the assistant chief, I said, well, can I pick up... I said, I haven't had breakfast. Do you mind if I... I was getting transferred to the downtown station, which is a big station, they call it. I said, you mind if I stop and pick up something? He said, well, yeah, if you want to, go ahead. I said, I want to talk to you when you get down. So when I went down, I was down eating a McMuffin or something. And he said, well, we've all decided we're going to start treating you like a man. We're not going to... We want you to come up and eat with us and be one of the guys, blah, blah, blah. So we don't want you to have a chip on your shoulder, blah, blah, blah. Well, I was a little bit reluctant to go, but I went. And he sat at the table, he started telling black jokes, you know, in a very derogatory manner. And I almost choked. And one of the guys came down and apologized for him. And I said, well, I'll have to eat on the condition that I be the goat. And I just didn't want to be that, so I stopped eating. So, and I made assistant chief. I lived only a few blocks from the station, so we had privileges of coming home to eat, or getting out from the station, so I came home. And then they started teasing me about it. I thought I was too good to eat with them. So it was kind of a no-win situation.
But in the early days, you're saying your wife brought you food.
Yeah.
But everyone else there would eat food that was
they would
prepared
cook.
There.
Yeah, right.
Okay. What about overnight sleeping arrangements? You said you
slept dormitory style we slept dormitory style, and they had a special bed for me with the administration bed, because they said that we worked 24 and we're all 48. So it meant we had three crews. So somebody had to sleep on somebody else's dirty linen. But for me, they had this special bed. I had my own linen and no one slept in my bed, and that was fine with me. Mm-hmm. I didn't gripe to NAACP about that. Mm-hmm. So that was just fine.
Right.
And if I got transferred to another station, my bed went too. Mm-hmm. You know.
How long before another black was hired on the force? How long were you the only?
Well, I'm just taking I didn't keep a record of all this. I'd say it was within maybe a couple of years.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And then how did it work out? Did more and more blacks begin to become firefighters?
Well, yeah, I guess you're going to interview Robert Coleman, aren't you?
I can't find him. I think he's out.
He's back in town.
Is he? Okay.
Well, Robert Coleman is a good friend of mine. He was a city commissioner. And by this time, Leon Dodge, who was a then fire chief, we all worked together, I'll put it like this. But Coleman and I worked in unison. He would work to get a black person on, and then I would go to the chief and talk to the chief. And at one time, while we had something about like 12% of the population, we had about 12 blacks on the fire department out of 80. We don't have that now. Different things happen. But we had the best record of, Paducah had the best record of hiring than any other city in the Commonwealth, I think, including Louisville.
be a firefighter in Paducah?
Well, I don't want to stick my neck out too far, but I guess if you don't tell history like it really is, you're not telling history. I think there's been more of a bias against women, actually, than there has against blacks. Because other cities have successfully hired women, but I don't think that Paducah really wants to hire a woman. A woman would have to not, she would not have to, well, I'll give you an example of something that happened. A woman passed the physical agility test, she passed the mental test, and they had a running around, in fact, around Tillman track field.
Track.
And she missed it by like 2 or 3 seconds, and they didn't hire her. You know, and I can't sit here and prove that if it wanted some man on the department, and he missed it by 2 or 3 seconds, they would have hired him, but they probably would have. Mm-hmm. I'll put it in that way. But they were determined to make her toe the line all the way down the line. And another woman, she lost a lawsuit. She'd been a stripper, but she had done everything right, and she'd been a stripper. And her dad, I think her dad had been a firefighter. But, you know, she was honest in saying she'd been a stripper out here at the place, and she wanted to elevate herself and so forth. And I think they really held this against her. But she had passed all, she did everything right. But I was on the interview board, and I gave her, I think, a decent interview rating, but she was given some low scores there. She sued the city, and she lost.
She lost.
Yeah.
Okay. Do you remember what reason they said she lost?
Well, I don't remember what reason, but it's very difficult. In this area, if you got a civil rights suit, whether you're African-American, woman, Oriental, or what, you better have all the T's crossed, the I's dotted, and the periods at the end of the sentences. Because if it's any way that they can go for the city, they'll go for it. I've been through some civil rights suits myself.
Can I ask you to talk about those briefly?
Well, I was up for assistant chief some time ago, and the interviewers said, we know we're not doing this very well. When we get through, could you give us some ideas on how to do it better? So I wrote a poem that was interspersed with four-letter words, and then everybody thought it was quite comical around the workplace, and this stuff goes on in the blue-collar workplace all the time. The mayor got a hold of it, and it was like I'd burned the flag. And so I got a 90-day suspension, and I went to federal court to get my suspension overturned. The union didn't support me. I sued the union, and I sued the city for discrimination. I lost all three of them.
Where was the NAACP involved in it?
No.
You didn't ask them to?
No, I just went. I just took it on my own with the court.
Okay. Who handled that for you?
John Stewart out of Louisville.
Okay.
You mean attorney, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Are you a broad-minded person?
I hope so.
I'll show you the poem and get through.
Okay. I actually wondered whether Mr. Freeland had...
No, he had got along in his advancing years. In fact, he's retired now.
He's not in the phone directory.
I know it. I don't know what happened.
Are you still living?
If he's passed, I haven't seen anything in the paper about anything. He should be moving way past 80 years old.
I'm going to ask you a couple things about him, if you can tell me. Is he white?
Yes.
He is. And is he Jewish?
No.
No. And I only ask that because I know that you have a a Jewish population here.
Yes.
Historically, actually, and wondered, but he's not. He's
no.
Not. Okay. What can you tell me about him?
I've known Joe Freeland for a long, long time, and Joe Freeland has all well up when he was a younger man, and he's very fiery and very vociferous against racial discrimination. And he was NAACP's lawyer back when Curly Brown was the president. And he was my personal lawyer for several years. And I asked Joe one time, I said, Joe, how did you get so outspoken in all of this and go to bat for blacks and so forth? He said, well, his grandfather mistreated slaves badly, held own slaves and mistreated them. And he says, well, I can't do anything about that. He says, I can be a better person myself. And it was a sort of like an atonement thing, that, you know, his grandfather did the bad thing, I'm going to do the good thing.
Did he grow up here in Paducah?
I don't really. He spent practically all his life here.
And he would have, do you know where he went to law school? Or?
I believe he went to University of Kentucky, I'm not sure.
Okay.
They say Joe had an IQ of 168. He was one of the highest IQ people in the state.
But he could handle NAACP cases and whatnot, and yet he managed to have a thriving law practice.
It's because he's such a good lawyer. He was when he was really at his best, he was I'd say one of the best lawyers in Paducah, and people. You know, they just, when people are in a jam, they'll put the prejudice out of their mind. They come first, try to get out. You know, they can go back to being prejudiced later. So they didn't worry about.
What kind of law did he do?
Criminal law. He did criminal law and mostly criminal law.
Okay. Well, I don't know why I can't find him, but if you have any thoughts when we finish as to how. I'd like to talk to him if he's still, you know, if he's willing. But I actually want to ask you about some other people too, but before I do that, let me just a couple more things about you, please. I understand that you write news articles and whatnot on black history in Paducah. When did you start all that? How did that come about?
Well,
it's wonderful, by the way.
Well, the way it came about, I found out I used to be an advocate for trying to win people over to not being, you know, we all got to live in the world together and let's try to cooperate, not be biased and stuff like this. But at the fire station, I just saw this was falling on deaf ears. That my crusading wasn't gaining many converts. So I said, well, I just started writing letters to the editor and let my views be known by the whole city. So I'd write these letters, and they would look at the paper and roll their eye with me, and I wouldn't say anything. So one time, one of them got enough nerve to say, I want to ask you a question, said, who do you get to write these articles for you? And I said, well, I'm keeping that a secret, but I'd like to know something from you. Who do you get to read them? I've always believed that you can take adversity under certain circumstances and turn it into advantage. And I said, well, if this is kind of creating a stir and they're reading the stuff, I'll just try to improve my writing skills and expand on them and write more and more and more. And it's pretty well mushroomed.
My understanding of the Paducah Sun is that it has been historically not a supportive paper about racial issues. How did it come about that you became a writer for them?
Well, that's an interesting question, too.
And first off, tell me if you think my assumption is true or false.
I think your assumption is basically true. I would say that The Sun is a very conservative-oriented paper, and it's, I don't know, one time I gave him a big blasting letter. There was a drug bust around town, and they had all the blacks on the front page, you know, five or six people, big drug bust. And the whites were included in the bus. It was several places raided. And back on page five, they had kind of a little small picture of the whites. And I raised the roof about it. And they printed my letter. And it seemingly, they like the other point of view sometimes, and I express it quite well.
You are a fine writer.
The Sun and I don't agree on hardly anything editorial wise, but they when I carry something down, they've got a real nice managing editor, Carl Harrison. He's a real different type of guy. He likes the merit of something. Mm-hmm. And when I carry it down and he reads it, he'll tell me, we want that. Mm-hmm. And so I've written several pieces that's gone beyond the letter to the editor, to the editorial mm-hmm. page. So I've done quite a bit of that.
It's worked out. And now you're working on a book?
Yes.
But that's a book about your personal story.
Right.
Right. How are you coming with that?
Well, it's a lady is doing, she's an English lit major, and she's doing some, giving me some suggestions on it, and she's doing a little rework on it, because I'm getting it ready for the publisher, in other words, mm-hmm. if I can ever get it published.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I want to ask you a couple things as we talked. You were at one point, I believe, the president of the NAACP chapter.
Yes.
When was that?
What? I was there for 4 years. Let me see. I got. Let me see if there's any date on this thing.
'92 to '96.
Yes.
Okay, so fairly recently.
Yes.
Okay.
Wait a minute, is it? No, it couldn't be 90. Maybe it was 96, I don't know.
But within the last 10 years.
86.
So 1982 to 86. What, how active is the NAACP today?
Well, I kind of wish you hadn't asked that question, because in my opinion, the NAACP has a banquet every year and that's it.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
They might do something else, but if they do, I don't know what they do.
But the Paducah chapter seems to have had a long history of advocacy around topics of race discrimination and whatnot, but not so much today. I imagine the banquet raises scholarship money and things.
Yes, the banquet, they get a good speaker in, and people go to listen to the speaker, and they come home, and from one year to the next, if they're doing anything, I don't see it in print. I don't know of anything they're doing.
Okay. Back in the late 40s, I've read that there was a group here called the Nonpartisan League. Mm-hmm. Can you tell me anything about them? That's all I know is a name that they were.
Well, the Nonpartisan League was in the 40s, you say?
Yeah, I think the late 40s.
Yeah, I don't know.
50s. Or
I know, really, to be honest, I couldn't tell you a lot about them, because I don't know what transpired with them. That was an older set, and I don't know what went on.
Okay. But it was separate from the NAACP?
Yes, I know that.
Okay. Do you think it might have been an organization that came out of the churches? Was it a mixed racial group?
No, I wouldn't think back then they would have had a mixed racial group. I think possibly the Nonpartisan League was a group of men who, I don't even know what their goal was. Okay. Were they wretched people to vote or what? I don't know.
Okay. And then a question I want to ask, if you might know something about the lawsuit that was filed against Paducah Junior College in 1949.
That I do know something about.
And I was interested that the first two students who went to apply were men, and that they later were drafted. And then the next go-round, I guess the NAACP sent two women, and I sort of wondered what that was all about. First off, people are drafted usually by local officials, local draft boards. Mm-hmm. Was that recrimination for having been involved in
that? Now, I don't know that part of it. I do know there had to be a lawsuit filed, and there were a lot of delays in getting, mm-hmm. It was called PJC then, Paducah Junior College. Right. And it was it took a long time to get that thing going. And there was a lawsuit that had delays. Lawyers can find ways to make delays. Mm-hmm. But anyway, Curly Brown was president of NAACP at the time, and the way they filed a case, I believe, on the basis that they didn't have a black junior college. We don't have a black one. So therefore, if you don't have a black one, we're entitled to go. You know. And I think that through a long legal process lasting about 3 or 4 years, we were successful.
Right. And then I believe Curly Brown's son was one of the first four students who actually enrolled there.
Right.
Okay. I wonder, I've read that the local NAACP worked for better employment in the 50s, and I wondered about jobs at the Atomic Energy Project here, since that's a federal program. Were they taking blacks into employment there?
I think they did. But back then, I think that blacks didn't have the choice jobs. Mm-hmm. They had the lesser. Mm-hmm. It was still, in the black community, if you had a job at a plant, Back when I came along, this is going back a little, if you had a job at the post office, or a job at the railroad shops, those were the two choice jobs. Now, when the KOW, I think they call it, when it came into being.
What is that?
The KOW.
What is that?
I don't even know what it was when they built the atomic plant here, they called it a KOW or something like that. Can't think of what the initials stand for. But anyway, if you had a job there, period, whether you had a shovel in your hand or were a janitor or whatever you were, there was discrimination there. But whatever you did there, you were going to bring home a pretty good paycheck. Mm-hmm. And you considered in the black community, well, he's got a job at KOW, you know. Mm-hmm. You were pretty well, had one of the better jobs. Mm-hmm. Now, I also wasn't here at that time, I don't believe. What period are you talking about?
I know the NAACP worked to improve employment in the 50s.
Yeah.
But I don't know how long the Atomic Energy Project has been in Paducah.
Well, I wasn't here from, you might say, 49, I came back in 53. Mm-hmm. Or four, somewhere along there. Mm-hmm. I was in service.
Right. Mm-hmm. Okay. But, so the KOW had black employees. Do you know how long they've been in business here?
They're not here now. In fact, my wife's father, she told me just now that he worked out there. Mm-hmm. I don't know exactly what he did. But no, I don't. But at one time, you know, Paducah was a boom town. Mm-hmm. Or it was flourishing with money. Mm-hmm. The money was floating around. But blacks never did get their share of good jobs. They just, the NAACP had a fight then to get blacks on the job. And later the fight became, after we get on the job, is to get them in every aspect of the job market. But at that time, it was just getting in the door.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Of course, the world reads about Paducah now with the health problems coming from the gas diffusion plant mm-hmm. operation here. How has that affected the black community here? Has it in any way?
To be very honest about it.
It's not over, but
I've started drinking bottled water. but to be very honest about it, there's a question mark that looms over everyone's head as to what's going to be done about this and when. But it's not like the roof is caving in. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, it's not like a tornado's coming. It's just like, well, it's out there, it's 20 miles away. We want something done about it. Quit politicking it and get something done about it. But no one is, it's not a major priority in the black community. It's not, you know, it's not like get it done tomorrow. Mm-hmm. And we don't know any more about it. We read in the papers. We pick up in the Louisville paper, they tell more than in the local paper.
Mm-hmm. Is it a priority in the white community?
I don't really think so. There are mixed emotions in the white. A lot of, I go to lunch with a white fellow that's in business here, and I went, his dad happened to be there one day, and he kind of didn't think it was, he thought maybe it was a big exaggeration about it. Mm-hmm. And I don't really know.
Right. And I guess for the reader of the transcript here, we should say that this has been identified as a health issue, and that there may be an incident of health problems that have come from
it's this uranium enrichment that gives off a residue right. of some kind, and they don't know what to do. They're supposed to dispose of all these barrels. They call it, they got a nickname for it, barrel something, but anyway, they're supposed to crush these barrels up, and they claim at the rate that they're doing it is just so slow that they haven't even started good yet. They're supposed to crush them up and find some disposal method.
And the uranium is leaking into the waters?
The ground.
Right.
I'm just making an assumption. I'm not a scientist. But it's just a matter of time when it gets into this river. I don't know what we're going to do right. if it does that.
Right. Okay. I want to ask you about some people that I don't have much information on, and maybe you can help me. In 1960, there was a fellow from here named Timothy Taylor who was appointed to the Kentucky Commission on Human Rights by the governor. That's all I know. Do you know anything about him?
What kind of type of work he did?
I don't know.
I think he's passed, if it's a Taylor I'm talking about. I couldn't think of his first name. He was head of West Kentucky Vocational School, I believe.
Okay. I can check that.
But I think he's passed. I know he's passed, in fact.
Okay. There's a fella named Edmund Wilford Sr., who lives over in Cadiz, C-A-D-I-Z?
Don't know him.
You don't know him, okay. There's a Mr. W.C. Young Sr.
He's passed.
Okay. then over in, I'm not sure I'm pronouncing this right, Kudowa?
His widow's still living, if you want to talk to her, W.C.'s widow. Her name is Carol Young.
Okay. Okay, and I think I do have her number, actually.
Yeah, okay.
There's a fella in, is it Kudowa?
Katoy.
How do you say that?
Katoy. Believe it or not, that's where he plants.
Okay. Named Ewing Benberry.
Yeah. Ewing Benberry. He's about 90 years old. He was one of the few blacks in the Republican Party.
Okay.
And he's been a pretty progressive man.
Okay. Do you have any idea at this point in time what the black, what percent approximately the black population is in Paducah?
We talked about that. It's around 12%.
Okay.
It's in the city proper.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Then I was, this goes back to the 19th century, I guess, but I was interested in the fact that Paducah at one point played such an important role in the river transportation back and forth, mm-hmm. north to south and whatnot, and wondered in all of that how slavery had played into that.
Well, I don't really know. I'm sure they used to have a mural on the old post office wall. They don't have it on the new one. Well, it's in the federal building now, where slaves were loading stuff on the boats. Mm-hmm. But I don't really know exactly. I'm sure that slaves were utilized in loading and unloading and mm-hmm. and stuff like this.
But were slaves ever sent south on the boats?
I couldn't tell you that. I don't know.
To plantations or whatnot.
I don't know. I don't think this was a slave trading area.
Okay, that's what I'm looking for. Was Paducah on the Underground Railroad that you've ever heard of? Slaves fleeing to?
No.
No.
A very important battle took here involving Nathan Bedford Forrest. Mm-hmm. And it was a black regiment, I can't think of the company name. They turned him back.
Mm-hmm.
It was right down here on the river.
The Black Regiment.
Yes.
Him back?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And they were their families or something were supposed to be set free. I don't know the complete history on that, but I've had, and they weren't. They were in the Union Army. The men were, and they were supposed to get freedom for their families or something. And they turned Forrest back. It was a cannon. They used these cannons.
Mm-hmm.
And Forrest had to leave.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Okay, I think that's all that I wanted to ask you. Is there anything else that we haven't talked about today that you think is important to share?
Well, you asked a lot, and you get me pretty well going. As I've said, Paducah, right now, if we bring things up to the present date, there are isolated pockets of where police have problems, but we don't have even police problems like they have in the cities. I read not too long ago where Nashville has a horrendous problem with the police department and blacks. Some officer may get out of pocket or out of hand, but we don't have savage beatings or shootings and mm-hmm. things like that.
How far is Nashville from the
140 miles.
Okay.
We, if you look at it from a total perspective, the races get along fairly well. And I'm not pouring any praise on Paducah, because Paducah does have problems, but I'm just telling you, we get along fairly well. We don't have hate groups that I know of that are out in the open.
Okay.
We don't have them going around. Somebody might have a swastika painted on their arm. Wants to see too much chaos happen here in Paducah. Everybody's cognizant of it. We would like to. Don't let me make a misunderstanding. Blacks want their full share of everything here. And in some areas, we're not getting it. We're not getting it in the courts. Personally, I think the courts, they're just shipping young black men away wholesale with drugs and problems of that nature. And they're not being absolutely fair about it. That's my personal opinion. We're not getting all the jobs we should get, but we do have a lot of good jobs. We don't have the same ratio of jobs. When you look at the whole community, we've got too many McDonald's jobs, not enough good jobs. Paducah's not any, it's not any paradise, but it's a pretty decent place to live. Mm-hmm. It's not a bad place. I guess I can say this because I've been one of the more fortunate ones. Mm-hmm. But I don't know what, you interviewed somebody that didn't have a job and didn't have a marketable skill. I don't know what they'd tell you.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Okay, you're quite welcome.